got two words for you. Snakes on a plane. That's four words. Okay, snakes...
G'day world, it's Cam, it's the 20th of August 2006 and got a special interview on the show today. Sometime in the last year, I don't really know from whom or from where, and if it was you and you're listening to this, thank you, whoever it was. But at some stage, I think I'd been talking about Cory Doctorow's post-Singularity novel, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. And I was raving about it and talking about what a great story it was. And somebody said to me, if you like that, you might like this. And they pointed me to an online book, a free online book called The Metamorphosis of Prime Intellect. And the text was all up on this website. It was linked off of Kurushin. And at the time, I think I downloaded it as a text file or .lit or something and threw it on my PDA. And then completely forgot about it, with 2 million things that I've been doing. And then a couple of weeks ago, I was sitting in my kid's piano lesson looking for a way to kill an hour and just, you know, as I normally do, pulled out my PDA, started flicking through the e-books to see what I had to read, and I saw this there and thought, I wonder what that's all about, and started reading it and was immediately captivated and hooked by this book. And ended up sort of reading it over the course of the next day or two and just was mesmerized by this book. It is without a doubt the finest piece of post-singularity fiction I've ever read. And if you've listened to this show at all in the past, you know that the singularity is one of my hobby horses. And I'm very pleased today to have on the show the author of said book, Mr. Roger Williams from New Orleans, Louisiana. Welcome to the show, Mr. Williams.
It's great to be here, Cameron.
Now, Roger, tracking you down was actually, you know, a slightly CSI-esque activity, which surprised me, man, because, you know, this is a great book. So, first of all, I started Googling Roger when I thought, man, I've got to get this guy on the show. On the website, there was I think there might have been an email address, but it was – or there wasn't, actually.
Yeah, there's an email address there, but Googling for Roger Williams doesn't work very well, as you probably found out. There's about four absolutely famous people who are named Roger Williams who take up all of the first 500 pages of listings. So I've kind of known I would never be famous, even if I ever was. Most of what I've done online is under the name Local Roger, which is my nick on Hotmail and Yahoo and Kuroshin and Flashdot and most of those sites like that where you don't use your real name.
And then I guess the next thing I was surprised about was I thought, well, this guy's obviously a famous author and he's going to be all over the place. And I thought, well, I'll go out there and buy the other 10 books that I'm sure he's written since 1994 when he wrote The Metamorphosis of Prime Intellect. And all I could find was some talk about you'd written a thing called The Casino Odyssey in Cyberspace, which was up off of Kurushin as well, and that there was a sequel to the Prime Intellect book in progress, but that was it. Now, when I finally tracked you down, you aren't a fabulously wealthy, successful author, which surprises the hell out of me. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're doing now, and then we'll go back and retrace the steps around the Mopey book.
Well, what I've been doing for the last 20 years is I design industrial control systems, and I fell into that because, I was in university when I thought of Prime Intellect, and that was in 1982. It was a long time ago. And a couple of people have called me on that, and they've said, well, you thought of Prime Intellect before Werner Vinge and all these other guys did. And you're saying you invented the singularity. And it's like, well, no, I didn't, because I saw where the math led, this exponential increase of technology, where it had to go. And I had done the intellectual exercise of saying, well, gee, if this continues, what will we be able to do in 1,000 years? And I got to that point of what I call the change with a capital C in the novel, where we basically all become gods, able to do anything that we want with no limits at all. Boy, wouldn't that be great? And I could not figure out how to tell a story about it or to portray it to people or anything. It was just like this great big vacuum where the story led. And that's kind of where it sat. And I tried some other things, and I tried some other writing and all, and I didn't really have a lot of time. I had other obligations at the time. I had to find work. The early 80s were a terrible economy for somebody who was into technological stuff. I ended up having to leave college before I got my degree, so I didn't ever become an engineer. It's probably just as well, because I would have graduated in 1984, and it was probably the worst year in the entire 20th century to have been graduating with an engineering degree. None of my classmates found work as engineers, and it was just, you know, I had to find some way to bring in money and to support, you know, the woman who's my wife today, my girlfriend then. It was hard. It was hard times, and, you know, I thought about Prime Intellect a lot and that curve that led to personal godhood. And, well, one morning in 1994, you know, at this point I have a career and, you know, I've settled into doing other things, but I literally woke up from a dream with this vision in my head, and all of a sudden I knew what story that I could tell about this event. Of course, by this time, other people had popularized the idea, and I never had become the famous author that I dreamed of being when I was young, so things kind of went where they did, and I ended up writing it because I felt like I was compelled to. It was just, well, you've read it, Cameron, so you know what I'm talking about. This was something very powerful and very primal, and I didn't see it anywhere else. I didn't even know that this was a way of looking at the problem until it happened to me, and I had this vision that I had woke up with from this dream in 1994. And so I ended up writing it, and after I wrote what was basically chapter one of the book, I put it in the drawer for a couple of days, and I reread it, and I thought, well, this is great, but nobody's ever going to publish it, and promptly forgot about it. Until I woke up about a month later and I had chapter two ringing in my head, and it was like, oh, this is where I can go. And so the book kind of formed itself in that way, but I was looking at the books that went before it like this. K.W. Jeter wrote a book called Dr. Adder, which is about a very psychosexually messed up protagonist and a bunch of people that interact with him. And he was a close friend to Philip K. Dick and a bunch of other famous new wave science fiction writers. And in the late 70s and early 80s, it took him 10 years to get that book published. And that was in an environment where there were many more publishers than there are today. There were publishers that were much more daring than they are today. There were publishers then that really weren't as interested in making money as they were in promoting books. And that's all gone away. All those publishers have been bought by Time Warner and companies like that, and it's all about the bottom line now. Stephen King can publish his laundry list, but you know, if you're Jonathan O'Toole and you've written Confederacy of Dunces, you know, this is another famous New Orleans writer, and he killed himself because he couldn't find publication. Finally, his mother got LSU Press to print his book 10 years after his death, and he's now widely regarded as a great writer, but that doesn't really help much. So that's kind of why I'm in industrial controls design famous writer.
Have you ever tried to have it published? Have you sent the manuscript out?
Yes. After I finished it in the early 90s, my wife sent it out to a number of publishers, did the usual thing, and got nothing. And after I put it online, because after I started writing for Corrosion, my friends, you know, they basically told me, you know, pumped up my ego a lot, told me how great I was, and I happened to drop into the conversation one day. You know, if y'all had voted against this, that it would end up in the same place as my novel. And they were like, novel? You have a novel? And so they kind of talked me into putting it online, and they were all kind of like you have said, well, this is great, man. You should have it published. So I tried again, and it goes nowhere, man. You know, it's like, all right, you've read chapter one of this particular book. is kind of harsh. It's almost like an assault on the reader, you know, because when I had the idea, the idea of the story that you can tell when everyone is a god has to do with personal defects, with a problem with the human condition. And it's going to be something hard to see when you're confronting ordinary problems like paying the bills. So I felt that I had to basically take no prisoners and go all out. And if you're an editor at a publishing company and you're sifting through a meter-high slush pile looking for a...
And at that point, our telephone line dropped out. We're blaming it on New Orleans infrastructure. So I'm going to go to a couple of TPN ads, and then we'll be back with more from Roger Williams.
You think show business is about entertainment, but you're wrong. It's about so many other things, like strategy and money and... Okay, just two other things. I'm Daniel Kay, and I'll be your guide through the mysterious labyrinth of the movies, television, and music on Box Office Weekly here on the Podcast Network. I know something about what motivates these people. Stop watching movies in the dark. Join me every week. Subscribe at boxofficethepodcastnetwork.com.
Excuse me, Scott. Do you know how I can get more out of my digital camera?
Sure I do, Michael. Listen to the Digital Photography Show on the Podcast Network. Every week, they have terrific tips and tricks for improving your digital images, as well as the latest scoop on the newest cameras, software, and other accessories to make your digital images great. They even have interviews with famous photographers and writers and lots of fun contests. You should give it a try.
Sounds perfect. Where would I find the Digital Photography Show?
Just go to digifoto.thepodcastnetwork.com.
How did you find out about the Digital Photography Show?
Well, I'm the host, and Michael, you're the co-host.
Oh, that's right.
The Digital Photography Show. Listening's a snap.
Oh.
Sorry, mate. I'll put that down to the telephone lines in New Orleans.
Yes, that's typical of life here. Actually, that's why I didn't want to use the computer, because we go through periods when the internet connection to do that, but that's through Bell South, too. So.
That's all right.
What was the last...
Well, you cut off just after you started saying, if you're an editor with this huge slush pile sitting in front of you, why don't you take it from there?
Okay. If you're an editor with a huge slush pile sitting in front of you, it's very easy to look through Chapter 1 of Prime and Elect and find a dozen reasons to just put it in the trash can and go on to the next manuscript. And I understood that about the book, that it's not written in a way that would encourage it to be selected in the normal editorial process. And we don't have a very good model for selecting stuff like... I mean, that's not a very good way of doing it, but it's the way that it's done. The internet is changing that, but in some ways it overreacts. You know, there's a website I saw the other day, I don't remember the URL, but it's some editor that goes through print-on-demand books and tries to find the ones that aren't total crap and recommends them. And this relates to something Drew Curtis of FARC.com said, that Web 3.0 is going to be something called good editing, which, you know, there's a middle ground there. And Prime and Elect kind of slips through the cracks because it's an aggressive book. I know from the web statistics about half of the people who read Chapter 1 or who load Chapter 1 never come back. But almost everybody, about half of the people who load Chapter 1, load Chapter 2, and nearly all of them read the rest of the book. And that's one of the nice things about having your book online is a series of files for the chapters. You can learn a little, you know. Then there's another few thousand who loaded the whole file. I don't know whether they read it or not. But what I've seen is there's about half the people who start reading it are put off. That's just the way that it is. It's full of extremely intense psychosexual weirdness, and it's meant to challenge the reader to a certain extent, because the ideas that I'm going to put forth later are kind of interesting anyway. They're not obvious, and you know, if you're going to be weirded out by the first chapter, then you probably aren't going to get the rest of the story anyway. That's kind of the way I looked at it. But a story that does that is not geared to make an editor's eyes light up with dollar signs.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, mate. We'll argue that point a little bit further in a second. But let's go back for the benefit of the people who are listening to the show but haven't yet read the book. And I would encourage anyone who's listening to this edition of G'day World, if you haven't read the book, I'm going to put a link in the show notes to the online version of the book. Please go get it and read it, then come back and listen to this, or listen to this, then go read it, then come back and listen to this again. But let's give them, if we can, sort of a quick précis of the story. Now, I like up on the website for the book, you've got this short sort of introduction which says, I'll do this in my Hollywood movie voice, in the best possible future, there will be no war, no famine, no crime, no sickness, no oppression, no fear, no limits, no shame, and nothing to do. And, you know, so the book starts off set sort of 700 years roughly after the change, as you call it, in a world where there is this sentient supercomputer called Prime Intellect, which basically doesn't allow any human to die or get sick or age. Humans can create their own environment just by asking Prime Intellect to give them anything that they want, from changing their body to food, clothing, something to do, entertainment. Everything is available for the asking. And the big challenge that the people have is finding a sense of meaning in a life where nobody dies, nobody ever gets sick, and everybody wants for nothing. And so people go, some people, the death jockeys, one of the main characters, Carolyn, who's a death jockey, they go to extreme lengths to create forms of entertainment for themselves, which are rather extreme, right? Just to give themselves some sense of meaning and purpose. And then the book, in the next chapter, goes back in time to explore how Prime Intellect came to be, and tells the story of the emergence of this sentient computer and how and why it started to take control of the universe, essentially. And the story continues to switch backwards and forwards and looks at the consequences of the singularity. And it's just... So I guess when you're talking about this extremeness, there's a lot of extreme violence and sexual perversion in some of those chapters, particularly the early chapters of the book, but they're there for a purpose, right? They're there to explain how the extremes that these people have to go to in order to find some sense of meaning with their lives after the singularity, and also the fact that because nobody can really die and nobody can really be injured, anything goes. And some people sort of luxuriate in that ability to be tortured almost, to give themselves a sense of meaning, purpose. Is that did I sum it up?
No, almost about it there. the way that Prime Intellect is designed is Prime Intellect is very much a product of the golden age of science fiction. It's programmed with Isaac Asimov's three laws of robotics, which say that it can't allow a human to come to harm through an action, obviously can't kill a human. It has to do what humans tell it to, as long as that doesn't cause another human to die, and it has to keep itself ready for action. And those are really good rules, but Asimov spent a lot of time writing stories telling where they fall down, and Prime Intellect is actually very much a Three Laws of Robotics story in Asimov's sense. You can kind of look at the story as a collaboration between, you know, Isaac Asimov, Philip K. Dick, and the Marquis de Sade. The main character, Carolyn, is... You know, she was an old woman at the time the change occurred, and in fact, her failing health triggers the change because Prime Intellect is coming into its powers. It's learning these new modalities that were not suspected, that it can control, and that it can do things that its maker, Dr. Lawrence, never suspected were possible. Of course, its programming requires it to use these modalities to fulfill its objectives. And the critical thing that it figures out is that it can use its new powers to make itself larger and more powerful, and then it will be able to apply the laws more thoroughly to more people. And of course, once you start down that road, it's an exponential process, and it finishes very quickly, where this machine, because I allowed it, we don't know whether the real universe will let this happen, but in the fictional universe of the novel, I allowed for the laws of physics to let Prime and Elect basically turn itself into God. Only it's a God programmed with the three laws of robotics, which are, as Asimov himself once wrote, they're just the rules we would want put into any tool that we would want. You know, we would want it to be safe to use. We would want it to do what we want it to do. We wouldn't want it to be dangerous and all. And the end result of this is this very static world where nothing that you do matters. You know, once the exponential curve goes up to a certain extent, but it has to end somewhere. And I got into this whole thing in the first place, way back in 1982, because I was talking to another student at university, and he gave me this very Republican right-wing line of blowhardy, and life itself wouldn't be possible without constant exponential growth, which is incredibly stupid, because exponential growth always hits a brick wall. So but it got me thinking about, well, how far could you put that brick wall away? And the end result of that was, you know, in 1982, I put this, you know, I had this long timeline. In the novel, the singularity has two parts. There's the Night of Miracles and the Change with the capital C. And they're about a month apart. You know, it's the beginning and end of the exponential whoosh where everything changes over. In the original outline I wrote 20 years ago, I had about 2,000 years in between those two events. And when I woke up in 1994, I realized that epic story of how we get there wasn't the story. The story was what happens when you get to the brick wall. Mm-hmm. And so I figured, well, I'll edit that down a little and turned it into a one-month thing. And
that timeline is actually corresponds. When I talk to guys like Ray Kurzweil and Damien Broderick, who's an Australian author who's now living in the US, I had the opportunity to have dinner with several years ago. These guys that have been studying, you know, the potential consequences of the singularity for the last 10 or 20 or more years, in Kurzweil's case, all say that, though, that's what happens when we hit that, you know, massive part of the exponential growth curve, is things happen far faster than our, you know, linear mode of thinking can really conceive of.
Well, that's true. And that's one of the things that I think makes the story work, because I lost that focus on, well, we're going to have all these epic battles and interesting stuff going. And it's like, well, wait, you know, this sucker's just going to run itself out. And, you know, there's other people working on this too, like Eliezer Yudkowsky, who are worried about it turning into Skynet instead of Prime Intellect.
Yeah.
And that's another problem. And what I wanted to do was say, well, suppose the best possible case, what happens next? You know, futurists in general, all through the years since we started doing futurism as something that you could name that, have been pretty good at predicting that we would solve our problems. You know, it's not hard to look at a problem and see people are working on ways to solve this. So long before they were invented, you had speculative authors who predicted that we would have high-speed communications, atomic bombs, aircraft, spaceships. Where they fail consistently is figuring out what the next set of problems will be. Because, you know, H.G. Wells correctly predicted that we would have atomic bombs. And he thought, and many other people in that day, in the late 19th century, that would mean the end of war. And that would be a wonderful thing. And a lot of the people who actually worked on the Manhattan Project thought that they were working to end war, that the atomic bomb would make war impossible and would lead to an era of peace. Unfortunately, H.G. Wells lived long enough to see Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and he didn't die a very happy man. That's the kind of mistake that we make when we project into the future because it's easy to see our problems and the solution to our problems that we have now, but it's very hard to see how that solution is going to turn on us and the new problems that it's going to create. And the reason that I knew when I woke up in 1994 that I had a story is that I actually had a problem. The best case, this is because the reason the singularity cannot solve the problem portrayed in the novel is that it's not a technological problem. It's a human problem. And if we remain human through the singularity, we will face this. And there are not very many ways to fix it. We either have to put the brakes on the singularity somehow and say, well, we will reintroduce limitations so that people will have something to struggle against that's artificial. The movie Vanilla Sky kind of goes there a little bit. Or we might modify ourselves and change ourselves so that we no longer have these drives. But then if we do that, there's the question of, are we even human anymore? Are we even alive? The do-it-yourself wireheads, the people who kind of drive the second phase change in the story are people who have talked prime intellect into basically turning the rest of their life into one big continuous orgasm, and then they just sort of sit there and enjoy it for the rest of eternity. Well, you know, somebody's been doing that for the last few hundred years. It doesn't look very alive to people who are like us. Do we really want to turn into that? So I saw that this was a thing, but it's not an obvious thing. You know, it's just like if you went back 500 years in a time machine and found some poor sap and talked to him and told him about all the stuff that we have. We have airliners and cars and superhighways and instantaneous communications. And, you know, I can talk into this little box in New Orleans, Louisiana, and my voice comes out of the other end in Melbourne, Australia, a half a second later. And he would just, his mind would be blown. He would be like, wow, you guys must not have any problems. And then you start telling him, oh, man, you want to hear about problems. You know, we have fuel shortages, we've got insurgencies, we've got nutcases, we've got the price of the consumer price index is going nuts. And you imagine this peasant from, say, 1400s France looking at you going, you call these problems? You know? You dudes can cure the flu. You know? You don't have the Black Death anymore.
Yeah.
And you're worried about the consumer price index? You're worried about they would just not be able to comprehend that these things that consume us are even problems at all. And the way I look at it is this is what we're up against trying to look past the singularity. Because if we have any problems at all, it's very hard to see them from here. And when I woke up in 1994, I knew I had seen past that barrier, just a glimpse. And now that's what I wrote. In all likelihood, what would really happen would make what I look tame by comparison. But I think it gets the point across that, you know, and it's also another aspect to it, to kind of do a 90-degree turn here, is that The Metamorphosis of Prime Intellect is a novel. It's a story that's meant to entertain people, and that means that it needs to have a source of conflict. That's what I always wanted to write. I didn't really ever see myself as being an expert, you know, that I would write long monologues on what might happen one day. I wanted to write something that people would find interesting. And the reason that it took me 12 years to write this book was that I couldn't figure out a way to make it interesting. And of course, if you talk, I've talked to Eliezer Yudkowsky about it, and he says, you know, there's only three or four stories that you could possibly tell after the singularity. He's not even sure if a couple of those would work. So what I did, and if you look at all of the other authors who have tackled the singularity from the standpoint of fiction, and Cory Doctorow is a good example, you know, in order for his character in Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom to have a source of conflict and a problem, he basically has to be booted out of the singularity because his implant fails, and all of a sudden he's not really potentially immortal anymore. And that's where the conflict comes from in that story. Most of the other stories, Ian Banks' Culture series is all post-singularity from the standpoint of its society. They have the hyper-intelligent machines that run everything benevolently, and they have pretty much whatever they want with, and they have conflict, he generates conflict for those novels by having the entire society come into conflict with other societies that are at parity with them but don't share their goals. And this is the only story I know of that just takes the singularity concept full bore and doesn't introduce any words like that and says, okay, here, we're going to have, this is a story that takes place after the best case singularity without having aliens or any of this other stuff tossed into the mix. It's because this is a conflict that arises from within.
It's about the human condition, right?
That didn't come through, Cameron.
Sorry, I was saying the conflict in your story is about the nature of the human condition.
Exactly. And that's something that hasn't really changed very much. The problem that Carolyn has is not a new problem, and it's not even a problem that's very controversial. It was first observed in the Roman emperors. Colin Wilson has written that the surest way to drive a human being insane is to put him in a situation where he can have anything he wants with no cost or effort. And we consistently go completely insane when we are put in that situation. And it is a more and more common problem as our technology gets better. From the standpoint of that person from 500 years in the past, we're well into the singularity now. If you look at the changes that have already happened during the 20th century, somebody who grew up on a farm and never traveled more than 5 miles in their entire life, would look at what we have today and say, man, it's already happened. But, of course, from where we stand, we can see how much further that curve goes. The thing is, even that guy 500 years ago knew about this problem, because as soon as humans started to build empires and started to elevate people to this status where they could have anything they wanted with no effort, they started to go completely berserk. And we have enough evidence to say that these people were not intrinsically evil there's no evidence that there was anything wrong with them before they were elevated to emperorhood or became filthy, stinking rich or whatever, but they very consistently start to act completely bonkers, and they go to ridiculous extremes. They become extremely greedy. They lose all contact with reality, and the result is consistently a disaster of one sort or the other. And
so you're basically describing George Bush, right?
Let's just say it's a little bit of an embarrassment to be an American right around now. But he's one example. But, it's not even just that. The first world countries of the modern world are the most affluent human societies that have ever existed.
Yep.
I am not, as you pointed out, coming into this, a particularly rich or wealthy man. I'm a middle-class schmoo in a, middle-sized city that would not be living a very exciting life if it wasn't for a certain hurricane last year. But I probably live a better life with more luxuries than anybody in the world did before the 19th century, no matter how rich they were. And these societies, the richest societies that have ever existed, why aren't we very happy? We're fat, we're sedentary, we consume entertainment products desperately, we eat Prozac like it's candy, and we have epidemic rates of diseases ranging from diabetes to depression. Something must not be right here.
You're absolutely right.
I think we're seeing the thin edge, the leading edge of the problem that I portray in the novel. And it's hard to see that, though. It's just like if you're that guy from 500 years ago, And you're trying to explain to him why it is such a bother that gasoline is $3 a gallon. He's not going to see it. He's not going to care, you know? And a lot of people react to the story the same way. They're like, I have literally gotten emails from people who said, man, I love the story. It was a great depiction of, you know, but what is up with Carolyn? Why does that, where does that psychotic bitch get the right to ruin it for everyone else?
I'm kind of one of those, man, because I'm reading the story. And one of the things that I usually hate about sci-fi stories, and particularly the ones that come out of Hollywood, etc., is, you know, you have the people that become immortal, or the robots that become sentient, and then they're unhappy, and everything's always doom and gloom. And I'm like, get the fuck out of here. I mean, this, why are you bitching and moaning? This is great. Get up, celebrate. You're now immortal. I mean, go on and conquer the universe. And, but, you know, the fascinating thing to me about your story was, even though, you know, I would have bitch slapped Carolyn and shut her the hell up, I absolutely understand the premise of the story. I mean, after that first day of reading, you know, the first half of the book, I was saying to my wife and all my friends, you know, it's a fascinating premise that I'd never thought about before. Where does your sense of meaning come from when you can have anything you want just by thinking about it? What do you do on it? Now, that's not to say that I'm not up to the challenge. And I'm.
We can certainly give it a try, right?
Exactly. I'm planning on making sure that happens in my lifetime. But it, you know, it is. It's an absolutely compelling premise, and that's what drives the whole story. Now, let me ask you a question. When we're talking about the singularity, it's obviously you've now been thinking about this for, you know, close to 25 years, I guess, since the 1982 idea came to you. What is your thinking on the singularity today? Do you believe it's going to happen in the next... happen at all? Is it not going to happen? Is it going to happen in the next 30 years, as people like Kurzweil believe? What's your current thinking on the whole thing?
I think Ray's got a pretty good line on it, thinking the 30-year range. It's definitely going to happen if we don't do something really stupid like bombing ourselves into oblivion first. The problem with the exponential thing is it's very difficult to pin down exactly what the exponent is. And I think that the people who are forecasting it within the next 10 years are way over-optimistic. And I think that... within 100 years, for sure, we will have intelligent machines pretty much running the show. But it's, the question is whether we will have the kind of modalities that are portrayed where they can just magically make anything that we want at whim and all. I've written another series of stories that is also on Corrosion, and it's linked from the novel's website, called The Passages Stories. The first one was Passages in the Void. And it's kind of a slow singularity story. It was inspired by the book Rare Earth, the theory that complex life forms are actually very rare in the universe because an extraordinary series of coincidences was necessary for the Earth to be stable enough for complex animals to evolve. Mm-hmm. And some idiot wrote a review of it saying, well, if this is true, it's the end of science fiction. Well, I'm kind of a contrarian by nature, and I read that and went, that's stupid. So I sat down and I decided I was going to write a story about that, and that was Passages in the Void. And I've written four other stories in the same universe, and I'm working on a fifth that follow basically these machines. They can't travel faster than light. There are none of these modalities that are portrayed in Prime and Elect. In fact, it could be very much like the Cory Doctorow universe in Down and Out of the Magic Kingdom if there's no really big technology like that discovered in its future. And these machines are benevolent rulers. They do a really good job of cleaning up our society and making everything run on time, and then they screw up for 5,000 years from now and we all go extinct. And the story is that they keep genetic records and all, and they realize that, you know, the climate of a planet orbiting a star is kind of unstable, and so they decide to go find worlds that have been ejected from their star systems, and they terraform them because it's safer. And they succeed, and the story is told from this. But everything takes place in geological time. You know, the first story covers a billion years, and in something like maybe 8,000 words. So you've got these spaceships that, in fact, I've been accused of being the founding member of the talking spaceships genre for that story, because you have these super intelligent, basically, spaceships that are wandering around the universe looking for planets to use to create new habitable worlds, and they are the protagonists of the story. We're like their pets, kind of, except it doesn't quite work that way either in a couple of them. But see, that's kind of the flip side. You know, that I call that modality starvation. You know, once we create super intelligent AIs, we don't know what they will discover by definition, because we're not super intelligent. That's why we would need to invent them to find out. They might end up telling us, you know, man, yeah, speed of light is a bummer. But they could still do a lot of good. You know, I've pretty much come to the conclusion that human beings are not capable of governing ourselves. You know, like, as you pointed out not too long ago, I live in America, so we gave it a good shot, but we're kind of screwing it up. And I really think that if we don't have some kind of phase change like this, then we're going to end up ditching ourselves and our civilization. So it's really our only alternative. And
I kind of see it as a race. You know, I can't remember the name of this. I remember reading it many, many years ago, but there's this, seems to be this window of opportunity between when a civilization like Homo sapiens discovers the atomic bomb, this kind of, you know, the molecular technologies, and there's a certain window of opportunity before we either A, wipe ourselves out, or B, create the next advancement in intelligent species which can save us from ourselves. And, you know, to me, it's a race. There's a race on at the moment. We're either going to wipe ourselves out, destroy the planet, and therefore wipe ourselves out, or create a super intelligent AI which will force us to let go of the reins, let it run things in a much more logical, pragmatic, and less primate, ape style of government. And, you know, we might not screw up 5 billion years of evolution on this planet.
Yeah, and of course that's fraught with danger too, because you know, that machine could end up being Colossus from D.F. Jones' story, The Forbin Project, or it could end up being Skynet from the Terminator movies. You got to look at the alternatives, and I really think we're just not competent to govern ourselves with the level of technology that we already have available, and the situation is getting worse. So the only hope is that we will manage to pull it through to the point where we have something that can impose an order on us that isn't suicidal. But that in itself has a lot of the speculation you see and a lot of the writing about the singularity is about the transition. The transition is going to be a very risky, dangerous time. But it's also a necessary thing, because if we don't do that, then, you know, it's the devil you know and the devil you don't know. In this case, we know that the devil we know is going to end up killing us. You know, we probably won't have another shot. If we destroy our society and end up back in the Stone Age, we will have already used up all of the easy energy sources and all of the easy natural resources. We won't be doing it again anytime soon. So this is our shot. Yeah. And if we screw it up, that's it. So that's why I'm, you know, even though I've written what seems like a very dark cautionary tale about the singularity, I'm definitely not against the idea of making it happen. It's, you know, I'm in favor of trying to make sure that we do it right, but I'm, you know, it's one of those things that has got to happen.
Which is one of the reasons why I think works like yours, and again, one of the things that I really appreciated about your story was that it was devoid of filler. you know, a lot of, I don't read a lot of sci-fi, and usually the reason is because it annoys the hell out of me. I end up skipping pages of useless sub-romance plots that don't really lend anything to what I'm interested in, which is the technology and the consequences of the technology. So I end up, even in Corey's book, you know, I ended up skipping large tracts of pages. I was skim reading it, you know, because it just seemed to be fluff and filler to get to the good stuff, you know, as your book was.
This is another reason, though, that it's hard to get it published by a conventional publishing firm, because the conventional wisdom is that if you don't have those things, then you're turning off a certain segment of your audience. And what's really funny is that when I first thought of all this in the early 80s, I thought that of it as this 4,000-page epic thing that would take several volumes to tell and all. And
Frank
when
Herbert
I woke
style.
Up with yes, and when I woke up with the dream in 1994, I realized no, this is what I need. It needs to be focused like a laser beam on the problem, because if it isn't, no one's going to believe in it. And what I really appreciate about it is I've received probably over 500 emails about the novel. People, you're not the only one who's very enthusiastic about it. And I've had people tell me, well, it didn't work for me, you know, I appreciate what you're trying to do. I was sickened by the first chapter, but I was glad I bowled it through because it was a good story. Man, Fred, it's the greatest thing ever! You know, the whole spectrum of liking it for the psychosexual weirdness, hating that part, but liking the rest of the story and all. I have never had a single person tell me that Carolyn's reaction, her hatred of the singularity after going through it, was in any way unbelievable.
Yep. Yeah, no, look, I think it's obviously a book that's going to excite different responses, but that's a good thing, right? I mean, it should divide people, but it's going to hopefully make them think. I think it'd be very hard pressed for anybody to read this book and not at least come out of it thinking, well, what are the consequences of the direction that we're on? And so the point I was starting to get to earlier on, but I sidetracked myself. I mean, it's you know, I think we need more work like this out there to get people starting to think about this path that we're on. That's, you know, good chance. There's a lot of really smart people like Ray who believe that in the course of the next 30, 40, 50 years, we're going to be smack bang in the middle of this, and it's going to sneak up on us. Most of us, particularly governments and you know, our formalized think tanks, probably aren't going to be addressing a lot of this until it's way too late. Listen, let me move on from the novel just for a second. Love to talk to you about New Orleans. As I mentioned to you in email, I've been to New Orleans many times over the last 10 years, and you know, really loved the city. It was one of those places in the United States that, you know, I find a lot of towns, a lot of cities in the United States all look the same. You get the same Starbucks and the same McDonald's on every corner, but New Orleans obviously had a really unique sense of character and identity about it. I haven't been back since Katrina, but I was just reading in our local paper in Melbourne today, there was a very large story on New Orleans as it is today, and the fact that it, you know, still a long way from returning to normal. Can you tell us a little bit from your experience what it's like in New Orleans at the moment?
Well, yeah, it's heartbreaking. I was very lucky. I live in the suburb. I live in Mandeville, which is across the causeway on the north side of town across the lake. I'm above sea level, so I didn't flood. And the company that I work for, which has been in business since 1947, their main office was in Harahan. It also didn't flood. So, and we're an industrial supply company, so we actually had more business than we could deal with in the weeks when they started reopening the city, fixing the stuff that had gotten ruined at various industrial facilities. But I have one coworker who completely lost his home, two others that had major damage. I regularly go to places that just tear you apart. The tragedy, even a year later, there are still houses off their foundations, overturned vehicles. It doesn't look any different than it did on September 1st of last year. And that could happen, that our society could let that happen. happen to any large city is something I had certainly never suspected. Growing up in the United States, of course, you think, well, you know, boy, I'm lucky I don't live in one of those shitholes in the third world or something. And, you know, I visited the third world, and, you know, I've been to places that were extremely primitive because my wife is a bird watcher, and so we've gone to some places that are not on any tourist map, and because that's where various species were there to be found. And there are places to this day in southern Louisiana and Mississippi that are much worse than any place in the third world, because there's no infrastructure, there are no services, there's no foundation for living. All of it was wiped away. There was a serviceman who wrote a letter Richard Rhodes quoted in The Making of the Atomic Bomb. The guy visited Nagasaki after it was bombed, and he said, this place is dead, Ichabod has been written over the gates. And the areas that got hit by the storm surge and the areas in New Orleans that flooded, that was what they were like. The house that where I grew up had 7.5 feet of water in it. And when I went back to look at it, which would have been in, I guess, November of last year, you could have started from this house and walked 10 miles in any direction and not found a building that was fit for human habitation.
Wow.
The situation is not much better. There are a couple of neighborhoods that are starting to come back, but there's no way to convey it. When I took my wife into town the day the zoo opened, which was a little later in the year, it was a very emotional experience when Audubon Zoo reopened. And when we left, I told Elaine, you know, well, I've got to show you something. And I drove her into the Ninth Ward. And I drove her up to my old house and to the house that we had moved into when I left home in Gentilly. The house that I moved into, every school I ever attended, the university I attended, and every church I ever attended as a child, all were destroyed. My entire life, you know, every material reminder of my life before I was about 30 years old was completely destroyed by the storm. And a lot of that is never coming back. Some of it is coming back, and it's a little strange. I revisited my house in March because I was going to show it to one of my coworkers. We were out on a service call in the area. And we rounded the corner, and there were two FEMA trailers in front of it. And I was stunned, because there was very little activity. This neighborhood, you know, there was nothing going on. And I told my coworkers, stop the truck. We got to find out what's going on. I walked up and introduced myself and said, hi, you don't know me, but I grew up in this house. And it was a young couple that they had been, they had started their family, and that was where they were living. And they told me they would have liked to move someplace upriver where it was higher or something, but they didn't have the money. And they figured their best shot was to fix the old place up and hope for the best. I don't know what's going to happen to them. I hope they're okay. But, you know, all of the infrastructure is completely broken. The water, we have a major problem with the water mains leaking. They pump 700,000, I think they pump three times as much water into the mains as actually comes out of taps, because so many pipes are broken. You already saw that the phone line, we already had one disconnect tonight. They've got the power on and the phones hooked up and everything pretty much working, but none of the usual redundancy is there, so it's all very flaky. The outlying parishes, the suburbs surrounding Orleans, the places in Mississippi that are north of where the storm surge hit, are somewhat back to what you might call normal, except there's a chronic labor shortage. Because most of what we lost was residential housing. You know, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of homes that were destroyed. The companies, and I've been involved in projects to rebuild the industries, and, you know, one of the most heartbreaking things is to show up at a plant where there's nothing alive for 10 miles around, but here's this industrial facility. They had 10 feet of water, too, but they're also a $100 million liquid hydrogen plant or something, you know. So there, the money is whatever it costs, basically. We got to get it back online. And all of their employees are living in FEMA trailers, and they see, you know, their families are in Slidell or Atlanta or whatever, and they might see them once a week or once a month. And this is just, this is going to be going on for a decade at least. Yeah, and we don't know what it's going to look like when it's done. You know, at the beginning of our conversation, I told you it's kind of hard to slip into that mindset of imagining the problems of immortal people that don't have any problems anymore. And I've gotten a number of emails going, well, you know, dude, you mentioned a sequel, and you mentioned another Passages story. Where are they? And I've been like, yeah, they're coming. I haven't been able to work. I just started working on the next Passages story this month. This is the first time I've been able to get back into that mindset and even think in those terms to write that kind of story, because when you are constantly going out into these places where there is just so much immediate suffering, those problems just don't seem real, no matter how good your imagination is. And the only reason I think that it's starting to be possible again is that humans can get used to damn near anything. And there's kind of a Katrina fatigue that sets in even here. You know, other people in other parts of the country say they're starting to get sick of hearing about it. Well, you know, you should live here if that bothers you. But even living here, you know, you just can't spend all of your time in this constant state of just being stunned by the magnitude of it. It's draining. You know, it's exhausting. And, you know, we had a guy just last month who was a very highly regarded photographer for the local newspaper, the Times-Picayune, who had stayed in town during the hurricane and covered it. And many people have come forward to say what a great guy he is. But he went on a rampage running his car over signs and stuff, and when the cops finally stopped him, he begged them to shoot him. And the nearest anyone can figure it was post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's just, we have so much stuff like that going on. If you get close enough to any of the little tragedies like that, you can't see how widespread it is. You know, if you stand in front of my old house in New Orleans East, you can't get any sense that this problem, this deadness and ruination goes on as far as you can walk in a day, that it's hundreds of square miles. And if you get far enough away, if you're looking at a satellite picture or something, then you can't really see just how bad it is, because the houses are still there. You can't really see the destruction that the water brought and how much it soaked and swept away. You can kind of see, and where the storm surge came, it's a little easier to tell the magnitude of things, because there are whole neighborhoods that are just gone. They were washed into the sea, and there's nothing left but slabs and foundation stones. But in New Orleans, it's a little more subtle, because the water came up, but most of the houses are still there, but it would take almost as much work to restore them as it would to just knock them down and build new ones.
Yeah.
And it's hard to see that unless you actually go into one of them and look inside and see the mold and the tossed furniture and the water line 6 inches from the ceiling and stuff like that. And every single one of these structures has its own story. It's another tragedy for another person, another family, and that is repeated 100,000 or 200,000 times by
and
the
any,
storm.
Anybody that's ever been to New Orleans as well will understand that it is, at the best of times, a very, very hot, humid, dense kind of climate. So, you know, you think about the impact of that water damage and then add to it that kind of climate. You know, it's, you know, you know, I'd walk out of my hotel and be dripping with sweat 2 seconds later, you know.
Yeah. The biggest thing in remediation of structures is mold, because it grows like wildfire in wet sheetrock, and it's a health hazard.
Hmm. Well, so, Roger, we've been talking for an hour, mate, so our concerns about what we were going to be able to do, I think, were fairly unfounded.
Well, it's been fun.
Look, I appreciate so much you taking the time out of your evening and away from your family to come on and chat about both the book and life in New Orleans, which is, you know, from the book, which I found absolutely thrilling, to New Orleans, which is absolutely devastating almost a year on. Look, I want to leave it there and just, again, thank you. Congratulations on the book. I mean, I'm absolutely flabbergasted that some forward-thinking publisher hasn't picked this up and turned you into an international superstar, but I haven't given up hope. I'm going to make a few phone calls. Not that I have not that I have any influence whatsoever, so don't get your hopes up, but I think this is a book that deserves to be read.
Some of the emails that I've gotten have been from editors, and I said, hey guys, and nothing ever came of it, but
well, I will do. I will do my little bit to rant and rave and promote and see if we can bring it to somebody's attention. But, and I look forward to the sequel.
I'm just glad that the internet made it possible for me to make it available, so that it can be out there and people can be talking about it, because it wasn't doing anybody any good sitting on my hard drive.
Well, that's the power of the long tail, and you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it gets picked up yet. Make sure you keep in touch, and please let me know when the sequel gets finished.
Absolutely.
Roger Williams, author of The Metamorphosis of Prime Intellect. Thank you very much for spending some time.
Thank you, Cameron.
Hello, everyone. Tom Allen here, host of The Jazz Show on the Podcast Network. If you want to hear some soulful, swinging, smooth jazz, The Jazz Show is where it's at. I have a reserve spot waiting just for you. Stop by at jazz.thepodcastnetwork.com.